because he wanted to avoid bloodshed.
I congratulate this great victory and the entire Muslim nation of Afghanistan, particularly the honorable residents of Kabul and our Mujahideen. We didn't expect such a fast victory, but we gained it by the help of God. I also assure all our countrymen of their safety. Don't be scared and resume your normal life.
As facts on the ground show, the Taliban are trying to gain popularity among all as a move to help them strengthen their rule over the country. They say their agenda is to provide security for all Afghans, including women and minorities who have suffered decades of invasion, war, injustice and insecurity. The fall of capital Kabul has created a big question in the minds of rural Afghans. That is, how can the Taliban bring unity, improvement and lasting peace to gain public support in the country?
We are tired of war and ask the Taliban to prove how they are planning to gain people's trust and support the rule over the country.
The fall of Kabul has prompted many Afghans to leave their country for fear of their life. Reports say at least 5 people were killed in the airport as Afghans scrambled to flee. According to eyewitnesses, American troops repeatedly shot in the air to disperse the crowds. Video released on social media showed dozens of people running alongside a U.S. plane as it taxied along the runway before takeoff. Afghanistan's Civil Aviation Authority says that the airspace had been released to the military and advised transit flights to reroute, saying there would be no air traffic control. Most countries have begun to evacuate their citizens along with diplomatic staff, with the U.S. planning to deploy more troops in Afghanistan to hasten its evacuation. Hundreds of Afghans, including those in possession of visas, have rushed into Kabul International Airport to get a flight and flee the country. This proves that the hope and optimism of Afghans on the fate of their country have smashed due to what most here believe is the outcome of heavy U.S. military presence in the country over the past 2 decades. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On Sunday, August 15, 2021, India celebrated its 75th Independence Day. In Indian-administered Kashmir, the main event to mark the day was held in the region's capital city, Srinagar. The region's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the national flag and took salute from the parade. The event was largely attended by government functionaries. The region's officials had temporarily relaxed COVID restrictions for Independence Day.
Revocation of Article 370 marked the beginning of a new era for Jammu and Kashmir. The neighboring country, which does not care for its own people, has been making malicious attempts to instigate our youth. They will be given a befitting reply.
While the mood inside the stadium was ecstatic, outside the people observed spontaneous shutdown to protest what they call New Delhi's failure to address the wishes and aspirations of the people. They say that New Delhi's stripping of Kashmir's special status in 2019 has further alienated the people of Kashmir.
Independence Day is important for every nation, and those who are celebrating independence on 15th August or 14th August across the border, they must realize that Kashmiris too have aspiration, and this aspiration must be respected.
The authorities had heightened security, deployed sharpshooters and pressed drones into service to keep watch over the region's capital city and prevent any attack by the armed pro-independence groups. They also issued directions to heads of educational institutes to hoist the Indian flag at their respective schools. The order has drawn strong criticism from different quarters. Meanwhile, unlike the past, internet and mobile services have remained unaffected on the Independence Day in Kashmir. Kashmir is a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts.
As India celebrates its 75th Independence Day, life here in Kashmir has again come to a grinding halt. Observers believe unless New Delhi addresses the basic issue of Kashmir and reduces the trust deficit, it cannot win the hearts and minds of the people here. Sayed Ali Safir, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Palestinians took part in a rally in the Gaza Strip marking the 20th anniversary of the killing of Abu Ali Mustafa, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Abu Ali Mustafa was assassinated in an Israeli attack in Ramallah in 2001. Palestinians said they participated in this rally to renew their support for the Palestinian resistance, expressing they will continue the road of resistance in defending their rights.
Today, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is marking the 20th anniversary of the assassination of our leader, Abu Ali Mustafa. By holding this huge rally titled With Knowledge and Resistance, we will build the next generation of freedom and victory. We view the resistance as the only way out of the current crisis. We have many allies from Iran to Syria, Lebanon and Al-Quds, which stand against the Israeli regime.
This rally comes in conjunction with the resistance front warning it won't tolerate any more Israel's reluctance to meet Palestinians' demands, especially those related to ending the suffocating siege imposed on the Gaza Strip.
Today, all Palestinian resistance factions are marking Abu Ali Mustafa's assassination, vowing to follow in the footsteps of their leaders. Today, Palestinians are involved in a continuous struggle against Israel, especially in Al-Quds, defending their lands. We call for a unified stance in fight against the occupation.
Organizers said this event marks the ongoing resistance until the main goals of all Palestinians are achieved. Resistance factions renewed their pledge to defend the Palestinian people and sent a new warning to the Israeli regime that the coming generations are the generations of liberation.
We believe that generations after generations will keep resisting against Israeli occupation. The Israeli regime should be held accountable for its crimes, and the international community should break its silence towards them.
Palestinians here stress on not only support their resistance and follow the steps of their leaders, but also defend their rights with all means until liberating all Palestine. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
What started as a quiet day for the residents of Keyham in Plymouth, southwest England, ended with a tragedy, a mass shooting by a white male who took six lives, including his own. The mood here, one of absolute shock and horror.
Sad as well, obviously, all the people that have lost their lives, the people that are injured, the people that are affected by it. It's just sickening.
It's completely wrong to kill innocent people and your own family. It's not fair. It's not acceptable. The guy needed help, evidently. He probably wasn't given the help he needed.
I mean, it is very scary. Like, you just don't want to go out, do you? You want to stay inside and be safe.
Jake Davidson, a 23-year-old apprentice crane operator, was a licensed gun owner who launched a lone wolf attack using a pump-action shotgun, according to witnesses.
It all started with the gunman shooting a woman in one of the houses up that hill behind me and ended with him taking his own life. Six lives lost in nearly 6 minutes.
Police said his motive was still unknown.
There is no motive as we know at present. Again, that will be subject to inquiry, but we are at the moment not considering terrorism or a relationship with any far-right group or any such other group.
But Davidson's social media accounts offer a window into his state of mind. A case in point, a video post on YouTube where he considers himself as the Terminator.
The whole premise of the Terminator movies is that, you know, everything's rigged against you. There's no hope for humanity. You know, we're on the brink of extinction.
He was also believed to have been a member of Incel, a notorious online community of celibate men with misogynistic views. Police have called the incident not terror-related, raising questions about whether the police would give the same designation if the gunman were someone from a minority group. The UK has stringent gun ownership laws. The last time such an incident happened was in 2010, perpetrated by a taxi driver who killed 18 people and injured several more. It's almost clear Davidson was radicalized online, which begs the question whether the authorities could have done more to prevent the horrifying killing spree. Saeed Puriza, Plymouth.
Another illegal move on Yemen soil has taken place by the United Kingdom as it has sent 40 soldiers of its special forces and an electronic warfare unit to Al Mar province in eastern Yemen on the pretext of finding the perpetrators of an attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman last month.
Such UK moves in Yemen are not new, whether in Al Mahra or elsewhere. Britain has an agent in the region, the UAE. All of Britain's efforts in Yemen, through its Emirati proxy, are focused on advancing the interests of the Israeli regime. What's happening today is considered a betrayal to the country by former President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi. He has kept mum in the face of the British-Israeli moves in violation of Yemen's sovereignty.
An observer believes Saudi Arabia is the party behind the recent attack on the ship and says the deployment of the UK forces is aimed at justifying the presence of Saudi Arabia in Al Mara, as the regime has failed to take control of the province that has the longest coastal strip on the Arabian Sea.
The deployment of British soldiers to Al Mara came in the wake of the attack carried out by Saudi Arabia against the Mercer Street oil tanker. Ansarullah was accused of being behind the attack, but this accusation was later denied. The presence of the British forces was planned beforehand, since Saudi Arabia has failed to control the province of Al Mahra, and many people there are against the presence of Saudi forces, and they cannot remain there for a long time, as there are capable military forces in the country.
The people of Al Mara have repeatedly voiced protest against the presence of Saudis on their land. However, the presence of foreign forces in Yemen is not limited to the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the UK. A US plane carrying 300 American soldiers and officers, along with 12 Black Hawk helicopters, arrived in Aden in southern Yemen last month. Yemenis say the recent UK move proves that colonial ambitions by foreign powers are rising rapidly amid fragile situation in the southern and eastern areas of Yemen. They have also made it clear that they will continue fighting until all of Yemen's land is liberated and foreign forces are pushed out of the country. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 10th of Muharram, known as Ashura. This is the second year that the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein are held mainly in open spaces due to the spread of coronavirus pandemic. Ashura is the day of the greatest epic of history and the most heart-rending catastrophe of mankind, namely the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his loyal companions, and the captivity of the women and the children of his encampment. It is the afternoon of Ashura, and Hussein, the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has been surrounded by the mean enemies. The Imam bids his last farewell to his family and relatives and hugs his six-month son, Ali Asghar. As he hears the harrowing cries of the thirsty infant, raises him high, asking the enemies for a drop of water to the parched lips of the innocent infant. But the despicable and stone-hearted Harmale targets the suckling fine throat with a three-pronged arrow, only to end his cries. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sprinkles the blood of his 6-month infant to the sky and asks God to accept this sacrifice. The moments pass very hard, but the Imam's face is glowing more and more as he nears martyrdom. His fighting reminds the enemies of his father, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Suddenly, one of the enemies strikes him on the left arm and shoulder. As the grandson of the Prophet has sustained myriads of injuries and lost his ability, he falls down from the horse. But his divine awe and grandeur does not let any of the godless forces to come closer to him. Finally, a miserable, ruthless man strikes the Imam with a huge lance. The stroke delves into the helmet and blood gushes out from Imam Hussein's head. But to the amusement of all, he is supplicating to God with the words, "My God, I am satisfied with your satisfaction and submitted to your command." Umar Sa'ad, the commander of Yazid's troops, shouts, "Woe upon you! Dismount and finish with Hussein." Sanan bin Anas dismounts and goes to Imam Hussein. He puts his dagger on the Imam's sacred throat, saying, "By God, I will decapitate you while I know that you are the grandson of the Messenger of God and your parents are the best of the people on the earth." The sky is gloomy as the truth has been mounted on spearhead. Ashura has transcended centuries and generations and has become brighter and brighter while inspiring all freedom seekers in every place. But what is the mystery? The bloods of Imam Hussein, his near ones and companions, were not like that of ordinary people. Imam Hussein's blood was the purest and holiest blood that was shed on the soil of Karbala. Imam Hussein could have saved his life, but he obeyed God's command and sacrificed whatever he had for the survival of God's religion. He was the one whose voice keeps resonating through the history when he said, "Do you not see that the truth is not practiced and the falsehood is not prevented?" Ashura has become the yardstick for truth and falsehood till the end of history. Truth is authentic and eternal, while falsehood is fabricated and transient. Falsehood is like the foam of water. In Ayah 17 of Surah Ra'd of the Noble Quran, we read, "He sends down water from the sky, whereat the valleys are flooded to their capacity, and the flood carries along a swelling scum." That is how Allah compares the truth and falsehood. As for the scum, it leaves as dross, and that which profits the people remains in the earth. That is how Allah draws comparisons. The Ahlul Bayt, or progeny of the Prophet of Islam, is the axis of truth and the guide of the Ummah. Whenever truth is deviated, they show the right path. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, "Where are you going and where are you turning your faces? The flags of truth are set up and its signs are clear. With these lights that have been installed, where are you going in astray? And why are you wandering while the progeny of your prophet is among you? They are the leaders of truth, the flags of religion, and the tongues of honesty. Place them in the best place that you keep the Quran, and like the thirsty, rush to their clear spring to be satiated. Greetings to the master of martyrs, Hussein, the inheritor of all divine messengers from Adam to Muhammad, and greetings to the souls that joined him."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Carver Tathway. The U.S. debacle in Afghanistan continues to bring severe criticism against Western countries who were NATO members, especially the U.S. Was the U.S. the country that stayed in Afghanistan the most to blame for the way that this 20-year war has actually ruined the country? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. deceived the world on this war and whether countries that have the U.S. backing are now doubtful of the U.S. support and what it can do for them. Joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Sayed Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator. He joins us from London. Also, Edward Corrigan joins us. He's an international human rights lawyer who joins us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Edward Corrigan, let me first start with you. And I'm going to start out with a question that seems to be on the minds and on the lips of everybody in a matter of speaking, whether it's on social media or even in the news itself. And it's a basic question. Is the Taliban investment that happened and now the fact that they're in control of Afghanistan the fault of the U.S.?
In many respects, yes. First of all, the Americans helped arm and train the Islamic militants in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, and that transformed into the Taliban. So the Americans, especially the CIA and MI6, the British intelligence agency, played a major role in installing the Taliban in power. And it wasn't until the Taliban were approached and demanded money to build a pipeline from the Caspian sort of gas fields through Afghanistan to Pakistan out that there became an issue for the American multinational oil corporation said that if you don't accept our offer, then we'll look at regime change. And then, of course, September 11th happened, and the United States seized upon that as a pretext to attack Afghanistan and also to invade and attack Iraq, both of which are important in terms of their energy supplies and we're also independent governments. But if you're going to, you know, attack the Arab nationalists like Saddam Hussein, who are the mortal enemies of the Islamic forces like the Taliban or Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, you know, you can't destroy the Arab nationalists plus, you know, attack the Islamic movement. But either way, the Taliban was a indigenous political movement strongly based upon the Pashtuns, which are the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. And they're, you know, fiercely independent. They want to run their own country. And, of course, they weren't going to accept the lies of the United States. The United States demanded Osama bin Laden be turned over to them. And the Taliban said, well, okay, we'll provide us proof that Osama bin Laden was involved with the attacks on 9/11. The Americans never provided the proof, but their response was to start bombing Afghanistan and then to invade it. And, you know, bin Laden was, in fact, a hero in Afghanistan to the Afghan people because of the role he played in freeing Afghanistan from the occupation from the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And the Americans, you know, were lying to their own people, but they can't get away with those lies with the people in Afghanistan.
Well, let's go back here, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, and I'm going to ask you for some examples in short, but one of them that's very startling that many have forgotten, but it was based on an expose that came out a few years back. That said, CIA-backed death squads in Afghanistan killed children as young as 8 in a series of night raids that were being executed, many targeting the madrasas, which is the religious schools. And in one example, back in 2018, one of the death squads attacked one in Wardak province, in which there was a child as young as 8 years old that was targeted in that attack. Just one example of some of the atrocities that happened in that country. So it's not as if the U.S. does not have a tarnished history there. You can expand on that for us or name other examples.
Yes, I mean, I think how many examples does one need to give? First of all, the perspective that you have to have is that 250,000 people have been killed in this war. Of those, only 1% happen to be American soldiers, something like 2,500 approximately. Around 3,500 contractors, U.S. contractors, have died. So you can see that the killing has been overwhelmingly of the not only the ordinary Afghan civilians, of which, you know, what's accepted is about 70,000 or so have been killed. It's probably a lot larger because these figures are all very, very, you know, they're very vague. Now, Afghan troops themselves, another 50 to 70,000 dead there. You see, we're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and the operations that were carried out were clearly, you know, inaccurate. Drones going in on supposed information, intel that they'd received, and picking whole families. I mean, we know for a fact that the Afghans live in quite large communes. You know, a whole family will live, for instance, within one sort of communal area. So if these drones and missiles were attacking these places, of course, there were civilians, children, women, you know, all in the same compounds. These were people were killed indiscriminately on not just one occasion, but, you know, on hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of sorties that are actually just indiscriminately murdered, killed and maimed. You've seen an example again of the aircraft that took off. Even with those people who were working for them, the scant regard for life was such that you could see that the American military was loading their dogs up quite efficiently. When it came to the Afghans that they, if you like, owed something to, presumably, they were happy for them to fall off or be run over by aircraft or whatever. Everybody's seen those horrendous scenes. This is the kind of, if you like, attitude that they've had to life in Afghanistan. It's been atrocious. I won't go into the money figures. I mean, $2.3 trillion, just for the record, is what it's cost them. The return has been, you know, abysmal in terms of every kind of measure that you want to put forward. And the American public itself will be footing the bill for all the loans that they've taken out in order to sustain this war.
Indeed.
I tell you,
has profited, though. All those corporate outfits that have been supplying opium and poppies and drugs around the world, 84% of the drugs in the world comes from Afghanistan, overseen during this 20 years of the US debacle. So, to be honest with you, military contractors, they profited a lot. You know, a lot of the corporations like Lockheed and Boeing and all the money men, they made a lot of money out of this war. But the losers have been primarily the poor Afghan civilians and people, and that is really very much on the doorstep of the American military and its leaders.
Indeed. I'm going to actually come back to you, Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, about some of those monetary aspects of this, which is actually a flashback. But before that, let me come to you, Edward Corrigan. You know, the last week, if you were to look at Afghanistan and imagined that the Taliban would be holding a press conference that would be broadcast across the world to explain what it's going to be doing and that it had a hold on the country, nobody would believe you. But at this point, that's what happened. And we just witnessed that press conference yesterday. Reassuring in some senses of many different things, such as the role that women are going to play, including a functional government, et cetera, in so many words. Do you take the Taliban's word for the way that they want to integrate themselves on the international stage, given the impression that they're giving at this point?
Well, I would be very cautious. The Taliban in the last 20 years have matured as a political organization, and they certainly have established themselves that they are a power to be reckoned with in Afghanistan. And with the ease, they took over the country. You know, many of the cities fell without even a single shot being fired. There was, you know, so that they're, you know, but it's not really a surprise. You know, generals and commanders of the Afghan operation have said for years that we're losing this war. You know, if you're torturing people, you're killing civilians, you're doing what's called double tap, you bomb a compound, and when people come to, you know, help, you bomb it again to kill the people who are trying to, you know, provide medical assistance. You know, there's, you know, massive bombing, the death squads, torture at various prisons. All of these things are designed either to crush the opposition, but what they do is, in fact, they fan the flames of the opposition and hatred of the Americans because of what the Americans and their allies were doing. So in many respects, the informed commentators were not surprised. I was not surprised. I wrote articles years ago saying, what are we doing in Afghanistan? This makes no sense. And when you invade a country, destroy it, kill people, you know, you're not going to have people praising you and loving you for this, okay? It creates a big backlash. And the Taliban, which are based largely in the Pashtun population, which is the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, they wrap themselves in, you know, sort of the flag of Afghanistan and being independent, standing up for their own culture, their own rights, their own political independence. And, you know, the Afghans are fiercely independent. Alexander the Great couldn't conquer them. Genghis Khan couldn't conquer them. The British Empire couldn't conquer them. The Soviet Union couldn't conquer them. And now the American Empire and its NATO allies couldn't conquer Afghanistan either. So, you know, it's called the graveyard of empires. And that's is very true. But when you are behaving in such a way and killing people indiscriminately, using torture and death squads and other things to try to crush a population, you know, the history proves that this policy actually doesn't work. Uh-huh. And it creates a big backlash, and people hate you for what you're doing.
Well, let's go back now to you, Mohsin Abbas. Let's go back. It's a flashback, and I'd like to test your memory to the year 2011. Mohsin Abbas, when Julian Assange, through the WikiLeaks revelation, said, and I'm going to quote him, the goal in Afghanistan is to use the country to wash money out of the tax bases of the U.S. and Europe through Afghanistan and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. The goal is an endless war, not a successful war. Again, back in 2011. Do you think that was the case?
I think Assange hit the nail on the head on many issues. America never went into Afghanistan because of the hunt for bin Laden or a war on terror. That was never the purpose. The purpose was always, quite logically from their point of view, given that they are an imperialist power that wants to dominate and does operate on the basis of plunder. In fact, makes his money on the plunder from especially the Western Asia sort of Islamic world for many, many decades. That's just an obvious thing to state. But part of that would be, part of that plunder was to look at the $2 or $3 trillion worth or more of Afghani minerals and, Afghan minerals and other, you know, resources that are locked within Afghanistan. It is not a poor nation in the sense that it has these kind of hugely, important resources. For instance, lithium. Lithium is going to be the future in the sense of electric cars and Tesla and whatnot. If you think about how important such a substance will be, well, Afghanistan has it in the most abundant quantity you can imagine. That would not have gone unnoticed by the transnational corporations, who usually are the ones who drive many of these industrial military projects which America fronts. So, they would have wanted their hands on all sorts of resources. Not only that, they knew about the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which was looking at Afghanistan as a major link within all that. So the Americans were desperate to try and prevent that happening. They, with their partnership with India, were also looking to allow India to become the major player in Afghanistan and the backer on the regional level. And that was something, quite frankly, that Pakistan was never going to allow. And at the same time, the Americans had this double policy where they were using the Pakistanis to, if you like, attack what they said were terrorists or part of their anti-terrorism war. Well, Pakistan, I would say, played America rather well. What they did was, on the one hand, they pretended to be fighting the war on terror, and at the same time, they were really training and preparing the Taliban, the neo-Taliban, I call it, and they prepared them on such a level that they were able to fight the kind of war which was fought against America in Vietnam. They used the same tactics, essentially, and cutting off the supply lines, cutting off the routes that NATO had to Pakistan. These things put America on the back foot, and Pakistan giving safe haven, essentially, off the record, to Taliban forces, replenishing them, etc., would also have really basically bled America. That's what ensured partly they didn't get what they wanted in that land.
All right. Well, Edward Corrigan, we've had some statements come from a number of countries on this issue. I'd like to get your reaction to what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, which overall he said that Iran is ready to cooperate with China and with Russia to establish peace and security in the country. And I'm going to quote him: Iran backs efforts to restore stability in Afghanistan, and as a neighboring and brotherly nation, Iran invites all groups in the country to reach a national agreement. Give us your take on what he has said, especially in the fact that this sounds like something that China and Russia obviously entertain, the approach that Iran has on this.
Well, Iran has a large border with Afghanistan, and they know that there's problems in Afghanistan that's going to affect Iran. And as it is, there's waves of refugees fleeing Afghanistan into Iran, and Iran has a lot of ties. There's a lot of Shia in Afghanistan, and people who speak actually the second language or first language in Afghanistan is Dari, which is a variation of Farsi. So there's a lot of connections. And Iran, it's in its interest, and it's only logical to sort of support peace and to try to maintain the country and to prevent any fallout that we've seen, like with the refugees fleeing from Africa, North Africa into Europe. It creates chaos. For Iran actually has taken a very large degree of the refugee flows from Afghanistan, as has Pakistan. They know that this is local. They know that they need to control the situation, and it should be done by the neighbors and the countries in the area, not by force by the Americans or the British or any of their allies coming in and sort of trampling upon the sovereignty and the rights of the Afghan people. And this is the same problem that Iran has faced, that all the colonial powers have faced, have tried to impose their will in their colonies. And this is simply unacceptable. And in 90% or more of the cases, it doesn't work. Like we've seen in China with Vietnam, but even elsewhere too. Unless you're talking about Grenada or Panama, the Americans haven't won a war since the end of the Second World War. And this is, you can't go in and just carpet bomb places and murder people and set up death squads. These are not aberrations. In Vietnam, the Americans set up something called the Phoenix Program that systematically went out and assassinated 60,000 South Vietnamese teachers and leaders. And this was done. And it's the same thing they did in El Salvador. It's actually got the name, the El Salvador Program in Guatemala. Israel's been doing it with regard to death squads, and attacking Iran and assassinating, its scientists. This is... we talk very nicely about, we're civilized, we support human rights, but when you look at what our actual policies are in the West, it's 90% or more, the exact opposite. Behaving.
Well, Iran has said, Seymour Abbas. Sorry to jump in, but the final question goes to you, Seymour Abbas. Iran has said, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, that the defeat of the United States has opened an opportunity to revive life, security, and lasting peace for that country. Is that what we're going to see, and in cooperation with Russia and China, perhaps, to come to the aid of Afghanistan in that respect?
Well, certainly any neutral would want peace, security, and safety for the Afghans. That's the least they deserve after what they've been put through by NATO and the U.S. forces over these decades. So, I think it's very encouraging that China, Iran, Russia, and Pakistan, and also Turkey, have been making really good noises about supporting this emerging governance. This is not the same Taliban we saw in 2001. These chaps have been giving amnesties to the workers. They've been allowing the government, previous government officials, to continue. They've declared an amnesty for all previous people. They've not been committing violence. They've been looking after also the minorities. So, for instance, the Shia minorities have also been very much on board. And this is partly because the Islamic Republic of Iran has engaged in some very good diplomacy with the Taliban over the years. And there is a very fraternal relationship that seems to be in place. Now, the danger is, of course, and this is the real final point, that the Americans and the West hasn't changed its attitude. Already the Americans have frozen $7 billion of Afghan funds, according to the central bank's governor, in reserves. The Federal Reserve has $7 billion out of the $9 billion that is outside of the country. They're not releasing that. So you can see straight away they're blackmailing the Taliban, because without that sort of money, of course, governance is is a lot harder. The Taliban has its own resources that are coming in. But this is now the question. Will NATO and the Americans allow the Taliban to establish, as they're saying, an Islamic government which is based on justice and the rule of law? That it remains to be seen, because they have their al-Qaeda's, they have their links with the TTP and others. They can cause terror in Afghanistan, so that's what needs to be watched.
Indeed. It's a wait-and-see game, obviously. Thank you very much for that, Seymour Hossein Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London, and thank you, Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
The Limelight. Indigenous groups in Canada are calling for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the discovery of the remains of more than 200 children at one former school last week shocked the country. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Monday, 31st of May, that searching for more mass graves was an important part of discovering the truth, but did not make specific commitments. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Reuters news agency, with a contribution from the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Calls to Find All Canada's Indigenous Mass Graves After Grim Residential School Discovery. Indigenous groups in Canada are calling for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the grim discovery of the remains of more than 200 children at one former school last week shocked the country. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Monday, 31st of May, that searching for more mass graves was, quote, an important part of discovering the truth, unquote. But Trudeau did not make specific commitments. Justin Trudeau said, as Prime Minister, I'm appalled by the shameful policy that stole Indigenous children from their communities. He added, sadly, this is not an exception or an isolated incident. Justin Trudeau added, we're not going to hide from that. We have to acknowledge the truth. Residential schools were a reality, a tragedy that existed here in Canada, in our country, and we have to own up to it. Kids were taken from their families, returned damaged, or not returned at all. Chief Roseanne Casimir of the Tecumloops Tessek Wapemk people said last week they had found the remains of 215 children, some as young as 3 years old, buried on the grounds of the Kamloops Indian Residential School, once Canada's largest such school, with the help of ground-penetrating radar. Chief Roseanne Casimir described the discovery as an unthinkable loss that was spoken about but never documented. In meetings across the country, Indigenous communities in Canada are now working to figure out how best to investigate, said Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, President of the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs. It's absolutely essential that there be a national program to thoroughly investigate all residential school sites in regard to unmarked mass graves, he said. Perry Bellegarde, Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, has said, while it is not new to find graves at former residential schools, it's always crushing to have that chapter's wounds exposed. Meanwhile, the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations and the Saskatchewan government have said they want Ottawa to help research undocumented deaths and burials, particularly at residential schools in the province. Federation Chief Bobby Cameron said finding the children's remains and giving them proper burials was important to help First Nation communities and families find closure. The Federation has compiled a list of initial sites where it hopes to complete radar ground searches. Saul Mamakwa, an opposition lawmaker with the New Democrat Party in Ontario, joined the call saying, it's a great open secret that our children lie on the properties of former schools. It is an open secret that Canadians can no longer look away from. Between 1831 and 1996, Canada's residential school system forcibly separated more than 150,000 First Nation children from their families as part of a program to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were subjected to abuse, to malnutrition and rape in what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, tasked with investigating the system, called a cultural genocide in 2015. They were forced to convert to Christianity and not allowed to speak their native languages. Canada's Indigenous leaders have cited that legacy of abuse and isolation as the root cause of epidemic rates of alcoholism and drug addiction on First Nation reservations. Opposition New Democrat leader Jagmeet Singh called on Monday for an emergency debate in the Canadian Parliament, saying, anytime we think about unmarked mass graves, we think about a distant country where a genocide has taken place. But this is not a distant country. Opposition Conservative lawmaker Michelle Rempel Garner said, "This discovery is a stain on our country. It is one that needs to be rectified." Last week's announcement sparked outrage throughout Canada, prompting flags to be flown at half-mast and people to lay hundreds of tiny shoes in public squares, places of government, and on the streets and on the steps of churches, in reference to the role that the Christian churches from a range of denominations played out in running the schools. There have long been rumours within the Indigenous communities in Canada, also discussed by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, of children being buried at these schools. The Kamloops School operated between 1890 and 1969, where the federal government took over operations from the Catholic Church and operated it as a day school until it finally closed down in 1978. The fourth volume of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report, titled Missing Children and Unmarked Burials, identified 3,200 children who died at residential schools throughout Canada, about a third of whom were not named. Since that report's publication in 2015, an additional 900 children have been identified. Parents spoke of children who went to school and never returned home, the report says. A working group established by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2007 proposed, among other things, a study to identify unmarked grave sites in Canada. While the federal government initially denied the $1.5 million Canadian dollars needed to conduct this work, the Canadian government announced in 2019 a $33.8 million Canadian dollar over 3 years for a national residential school student death register and an online registry of residential school cemeteries. Richard Gagnon, Archbishop of Winnipeg and President of the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, said he wanted to express our deepest sorrow for the heart-rending loss of the children at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School.